Well, I think as we are having a quorum, I think we should start.
Does this work?
Yes, it should work as soon as you press the button. It's a, in principle, one-hour session with three speakers. Ron, may I ask you to sit at the table, because at a certain point in time, I will have to invest the power of the bell into someone else than me, because I will be the speaker, and someone could control me. I think you're the best person to control me. You've so far succeeded.
Well, you know that never works, right?
No, I know, but that's why I'm asking.
Usually it's more Ron who gets left with nothing.
But this is a one-hour one. We were trying to make it a one-hour event. Speakers will be Eric Ross here from the Institute of Social Studies. Where are we? Eric will be speaking about AIDS, the scientific mindset and structure of science. And we have Gilles Levine, who is here also already, who addresses the issue of critique of the assumptions underlying the training of scientists for the developing world, and myself speaking on the broad title, Not by Science Alone. So, Eric.
Thank you. The paper, which this is very short, but a quick version, is concerned with aspects of the scientific mind in terms of the persistent challenge of AIDS, and considers in that context the changes in the nature of science as determined by its being embedded in the political economy of capitalism. It raises some fundamental questions on how we differentiate between the nature of scientific thought as a way of systematizing knowledge, and on the other hand, the political and economic system in which scientists think and work and establish their research priorities. It's now more than 20 years since AIDS was first seized our attention. Yet, as University of California AIDS dissident retrovirologist Peter Duisberg has written, the hypothesis that human immunodeficiency virus HIV is a new sexually transmitted virus that causes AIDS has been entirely unproductive in terms of public health benefits. Moreover, it fails to predict the epidemiology of AIDS, the annual AIDS risk, and the very heterogeneous AIDS diseases of infected persons. The correct hypothesis must explain why, one, AIDS includes 25 previously known diseases, and two, clinically and epidemiologically very different epidemics, one in America and Europe, and one in Africa. Duisberg has argued that the very different patterns of AIDS prevalence and diseases in Africa and the U.S. cannot be explained in terms of a single HIV-caused pandemic. Yet, at present, when the evidence in support of his view is increasing, hostility toward the questioning of the conventional so-called HIV-AIDS wisdom has in fact not diminished. Scientific reasoning potentially provides a way of correcting some of the unproductive assumptions on which the HIV-AIDS model is based. But first, it must be willing to recognize and to challenge those assumptions, or at least tolerate degrees of heterodoxy. And this hasn't been a distinguishing feature of the AIDS debate. I would suggest that this is because one of the crucial limitations in thinking about AIDS has generally been the separation of a strictly epidemiological from a sociological consideration, so that the scientific study of AIDS has been largely built on a narrow, if not reductionist, view of disease causation. This is not really surprising. In the decades after the eminent 19th century German pathologist Rudolf Virchow wrote that medicine is social science or it is nothing, medical science generally took a markedly different road, becoming increasingly detached from concerns about the social conditions in which diseases emerged. Virchow's radical perspective was overwhelmed by the professionalization of science in general and of medicine in particular, which reflected the advance of Western capitalism. Few scientists have commented as openly or poignantly on the implications of this change in science and the scientific mind and practice as the great chemist Erwin Chargaff, who wrote in 1980 of how the face of science has changed more in the last 15 years than it did during all the previous history. He spoke especially of what he called the technicalization of science. As Western science in general is increasingly focused on technical solutions, medical science in particular has tended to distance itself from Virchow's vision. Epidemiologists and medical researchers generally fail to regard disease in terms of its social and economic dimension. Which has been argued in recent times by such writers and thinkers as Thomas McKeown, who pointed out in The Role of Medicine, Dream, Mirage, or Nemesis, that contrary to popular and professional wisdom, declining mortality from major infectious diseases largely predated medical interventions and were in fact chiefly attributable to improvements in economic environment and especially better nutrition. Now, I just give a very brief example, which is quite illustrative, and that is from the example of pellagra. By the end of the 19th century, the germ theory had achieved prominence against the background of an increasingly technical approach to medicine, and almost everybody was searching for a unique pathogen that caused a specific disease. Such an approach often had the support of conservative forces hostile to social and economic interpretation of disease. In the decade before the First World War, when pellagra was spreading rapidly through the southern United States, it was widely regarded as caused by an infectious agent. This interpretation was definitively challenged by the research of Joseph Goldberger, who demonstrated that pellagra was a dietary deficiency caused chiefly by poverty, which in turn he attributed to the exploitative tenant farming system and low-wage cotton mill towns which dominated the southern economy in his time. For that reason, Goldberger's conclusions were in fact strongly resisted, and between 1914, when he made his discoveries, and 1928, the year he died, the reported pellagra deaths actually multiplied eightfold. The question I pose is why, in the light of what we know now of diseases such as pellagra and others, why has modern medical science reverted to a narrow technical search for the cause of AIDS? Now, the reason is similar to that which kept Goldberger's insights into pellagra from gaining headway. It raises fundamental questions about whether we can expect the scientific mind to help free us from the constraints of the economic and political orthodoxies of our age. After the first cases of AIDS were documented in Africa in 1982, there was a rush to blame AIDS on the same sexual practices that had long been regarded as the source of the region's population problem, to which the underdevelopment of the region had long been ascribed. In terms of the epidemiological history of the region, the orthodox Western prognosis for AIDS in Africa therefore represented nothing very new. From early on, when it was necessary to consider why the spread of AIDS was characterized by a relatively balanced sex ratio in sub-Saharan Africa compared to the overwhelming number of cases among homosexual men in Western countries like the U.S., colonial assumptions about African sexual behavior determined, as has been written, the central focus of medical inquiries into the problem of AIDS. This was certainly where the research funding went. There were only a few writers, among them Meredith Tertian of Rutgers University, who bravely questioned whether we should not also be looking at political economic factors and to the vulnerability of people whose immune systems were compromised by poverty and malnutrition. A similar position was taken in the World Development Movement's 1999 report, which noted, while not restricted solely to poor people, AIDS is a disease of poverty, marginalization, and social and economic injustice. In countries like Kenya, for example, half of the population was unable to consume a minimum requirement of food and essential non-food commodities. Tertian still subscribed to the conventional view that the sexual transmission of HIV caused AIDS. But University of California retrovirus specialist Peter Duisberg has made a powerful argument over the past 15 years that this is very unlikely. And recently, David Giselquist and his colleagues in an article in the International Journal of STDs and AIDS have lent significant support to Duisberg's position when they conclude from a survey of the literature that there is little correspondence between patterns of HIV prevalence or AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa and patterns of sexual behavior. This strongly suggests the need for a systematic reconsideration of the epidemiology of AIDS, at the heart of which should be a focus on the economic, social, and environmental policies such as structural adjustment, and their cumulative impact on the human immune system and its capacity to respond to the development-related resurgence of many of the diseases that are currently subsumed under the rubric of AIDS. In this respect, the timing of the first AIDS cases in Africa is instructive. Until the early 70s, the Kenyan economy, for example, was relatively successful. But the relative prosperity of countries such as Kenya waned with changes in the world economy, including dramatic increases in 1973 and 1979 with oil prices, and the United States driving up interest rates to unprecedented levels, causing debts contracted with floating interest rates to spiral upward. At the same time, most countries of sub-Saharan Africa faced a serious decline in the price of their major exports. By the early 1980s, such trends had forced most of these economies, which were experiencing a severe rise in their balance of payments current account deficit, to increase their dependence on unilateral loans and to assume unprecedented levels of external debt. Structural adjustment as a requirement for debt rescheduling came soon after, but scarcely solved the problem. In 1982, $18.2 billion still went to developing economies. By 1990, $52 billion a year was actually being transferred out, and developing countries were reducing their investment in health and intensifying export production at the expense of subsistence security. Despite these trends, the International Monetary Fund and World Bank were taking credit for what they called an African economic renaissance, claiming along with the both of them, the IMF and the World Bank, claiming that the structural adjustment policies they had applied to countries such as Kenya had paid off. This claim is widely disputed, but the idea that African countries are economically on the upswing defines the prevailing framework within which the bank, the IMF, and OECD countries typically address many third world issues, among them AIDS. Because the IMF and the bank are necessarily optimistic about the effects of their policies on the economies of countries such as Kenya, they are disinclined to view AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa as a function of poverty. On the contrary, the World Bank maintains that the main impediment to sustained economic prosperity in sub-Saharan Africa is AIDS. And because it attributes AIDS exclusively to HIV, and HIV transmission to sexual behavior, the bank has effectively reduced underdevelopment in Africa to reproductive health issues which largely hinge on individual responsibility. The question today is whether science has challenged or abetted this view, whether it has followed a set of assumptions that reflect a colonialist legacy and the policy interests of the Bretton Woods institutions, and failed to look at the realities of AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa in a broader, less technical way. As with Goldberger's contextualization of the etiology of pellagra in the political economy of the American South in the 20s, the necessity today is for medical science investigating AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa to transcend the biomedical model and explore the cumulative impact of the structural determinants of malnutrition and adverse environmental change on the immune function of the global poor. In 1999, the World Development Movement noted that one-third of children in Africa are significantly malnourished. Malnutrition seriously impairs the immune system. As a result, in 1998, in the State of the World's Children Report, UNICEF concluded, quote, that malnutrition impairs the immune system of at least 100 million young children and several million pregnant women, none of them infected by HIV. Despite this, Western science, by generally adhering to a restrictive medical model, has failed to challenge the conventional AIDS model and has effectively followed the AIDS agenda of others, not least the World Bank. Why has the critical nature of scientific reasoning so far failed to question such views? And why has mainstream science not challenged resistance to an alternative interpretation of AIDS? I suspect the answer lies, as Chargaff realized, in the motive forces of contemporary science. It prompted Paul Farmer and his colleagues to write in a letter to Nature, given the strong correlation between poverty and AIDS, one might question the priorities of those scientists who have chosen to battle with dissident colleagues rather than making the main thrust of their campaign the epidemiology of a disease worsened by sustained indebtedness. The question I would ask, then, is not about the role of the scientific mind per se, but the role to which contemporary science consigns the dissident mind. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric. The structure of the session is that we have the three presenters, one after the other, and quite exceptionally for this afternoon, it's followed by half an hour plenary debate, so there is, I can't say ample, but there is some opportunity at least for the audience to reflect on this. Otherwise, the principle is obviously that this is food for thought that you take into account while you conduct your discussion in your various special interest groups.